Hey, Micro Savage Lovecast listeners. This week, we're giving you a little taste, more like a heaping serving, actually, of the kind of convos Magnum subs get to enjoy here on Sex and Politics, our bonus podcast for our paid subscribers. We're sharing this part of my conversation with author Rob Henderson with you. I hope you enjoy it, and we hope it inspires you to think about becoming one of my subs.
You're listening to Sex and Politics at savage.love.
You know, I don't know who was more surprised, Rob Henderson when we asked him to come on the show, or me when Rob Henderson agreed to come on the show. Henderson writes the Rob Henderson newsletter on Substack, and he is the author of Troubled, a memoir of foster care, family, and social class, which is out now. Rob had a rough early life, which we talk about, before Rob wound up at Yale, where he arrived not with a chip on his shoulder, but with an outsider's eye. He graduated from Yale 4 years later with, depending on your point of view, either a chip on his shoulder or a stinging and legitimate critique of the elites, which Rob is now, by dint of his education and his success as a thinker and public intellectual, definitely a part of, whether he likes it or not. This is Sex and Politics. I'm Dan Savage. This is a special bonus podcast we do for Magnum subscribers of the Savage Lovecast. If you can hear my voice, you are a Magnum sub. Thank you so much for your support. Our last two guests here on Sex and Politics, Tim Miller, Kat Rosenfield, perceived as, I guess, in Tim Miller's case, a right-winger, used to be a highly placed Republican operative, worked for George Bush, had white wine spritzers in a hotel lobby once with none other than Lindsey Graham. Tim is now the host of the Bulwark's flagship podcast, The Bulwark. Kat Rosenfield, novelist, podcaster, columnist, perceived, I think, inaccurately as center-right, accused sometimes of being right-right. Anyway, those were our last two guests, and after those shows, I got some pushback. Why so many right-leaning or right-recovering guests on the show? Why so many guests to my right politically? Why not some guests to my left? Why not a communist or a socialist? I like to think that I'm the socialist on the show, in the style of mainstream European socialist parties. But I took that critique to heart. We need to get some commies in here. And we will. But not this week. Because I wanted to talk to Rob about his new book and about his concept, the concept he's most famous for, of luxury beliefs. These are, as Rob writes, beliefs elites hold that cost them nothing but inflict damage on the working class. And among the things that Rob Henderson has identified as a luxury belief is non-monogamy, open relationships, being monogamish, polyamory. I wanted to have him on to have a conversation about that and to really drill down. Rob has appeared on a lot of other podcasts in the last few weeks after his book came out, which I read and which I really, really was very moved by. And his sort of dinging of non-monogamy as a luxury belief that does damage to the working class was mentioned, but never really unpacked, never drilled down on. And that's why I wanted to have him on the show, because I wanted to drill down on that. And we do. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Rob Henderson. Rob, welcome to the show. I really appreciate you being here.
Thanks, Dan. Great to be here.
You sent ahead, it seems that you were concerned we might argue, and sent ahead a piece for me to read before we spoke, in addition to the book, called You're Not the Person I Am Judging. Thank you for that.
Yeah, well, you had sent a couple of calls, and, you know, I've read about you, and, you know, I think people sometimes mistakenly think that I'm this sort of hard-nosed, super social conservative or something. And I don't think of myself in that way. It sounds like you've read my book, or at least parts of it. And I think some of that does come through, that I'm not this finger wagging person, but I do have some strong beliefs around kids and family and those kinds of things.
You know, going into this, it's not that I'm afraid that we're going to argue the whole time and argue about everything. I'm afraid that we're going to spend too much time agreeing about too much and kind of freak out my listeners, because you are sort of pegged right now as, I don't know, on the conservative side, but you're on a conservative side of some family issues. The importance of family stability, constancy, which I think is a really unsung virtue, showing up, being there, and being the same every day for at least the first 15, 20 years for your kids as the person you were the day before. Mm. I think all those things are important. And I wrote about those things in my memoir about adopting, and my memoir about marriage and my family. And back then when those books came out, some people attacked me for being socially conservative and overvaluing or emphasizing too much the importance of the two-parent home.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, I wrote this book, you know, not even trying to have a political angle. The words conservative or liberal or any of those things, there's no politically charged labels in the book. It was more just my firsthand experiences growing up without family stability and what that did to me, and seeing the lives of my friends, my foster siblings, so many of the young people that I grew up with, and how their lives, you know, their life trajectories and how they ended up. And yeah, I just think family is such an important piece of the puzzle in our early life that often doesn't get discussed that much in educated circles. And so I'm trying to, you know, get people to speak more about it.
And it doesn't get discussed much in educated circles because, at least in educated circles, it can kind of be taken for granted. Backing way up, you're best known for the concept of luxury beliefs, and we're going to get to that and one particular thing you describe as a luxury belief in a minute. But first, for listeners of mine, for people who may not be listening to Jordan Peterson's podcast or picking up books blurbed by J.D. Vance, tell us about yourself, your background, and your story growing up, which is what the book is mostly about. It's a memoir mostly about your childhood and then kind of an introduction to your philosophy of luxury beliefs there at the end, and a fascinating one. But give us the background.
Yeah. Thanks, Dan. I recently received a PhD from the University of Cambridge on a Gates scholarship, went to Yale for undergrad, and sort of spent the last few years in and around these elite universities. But before that, my life was a lot different. You know, backing way up, I was born into poverty in Los Angeles. Never knew my father to this day, never met him. And my birth mother, she and I were homeless for a time. And then we lived in a car. And then by the time I was old enough to form memories, we had settled in a slum apartment in LA. Yeah, I have a lot of this information because later I received this sort of thick document full of information from social workers and forensic psychologists and all of the people who were involved in my case when I was in the system in LA. But my mom would tie me to a chair while she got high so that I, you know, couldn't interrupt her. Eventually, some neighbors called the police. You know, they heard this kid screaming in this apartment, and it was me, and the police arrived, and you know, they arrested her and they asked her. And then she was also asked by some forensic psychologists, where's this boy's father? She didn't know. She had no idea who he was. She would have people coming in and out of the apartment at all hours of the day and night, trading favors for drugs. And so, you know, actually, quite recently, I did learn something about my biological father. So I took a 23andMe genetic ancestry test. And my whole life, I grew up thinking, oh, you know, kind of biracial, mixed race, Asian American. My mother was from Korea, from Seoul. She came to the U.S. as a young woman to study and then started partying, and her life kind of unraveled. My father, I learned from this test, he was Hispanic. So I'm half Hispanic, half Mexican on my father's side. But that was, you know, a recent piece of information. I spent the next 5 years after I was taken from my mother's care in 7 different foster homes all over LA, and I describe my experiences. Some of these homes had upwards of 8 or 10 kids living in them, a lot of kind of squalor and disorder. I recently read that LA actually is the most overburdened among sort of large cities and in terms of foster care, like lack of placements for kids. I don't know if that was the case in the 90s, but I do remember some of these homes just sort of teeming with kids and not a lot of oversight. Eventually, I was adopted by this working class family. We settled in this dusty blue-collar town in Northern California called Red Bluff. It's in one of the poorest counties in California. And my adoptive parents were very working class. My adoptive father was a truck driver. My adoptive mom was an assistant social worker. And they eventually divorced. My adoptive father stopped speaking with me. And I was 9 years old by this point. And after never knowing my father and all of the foster homes, and then, you know, this man who I was happy to call dad after the adoption, for him to suddenly stop speaking with me simply because he was angry at my mother for leaving him, and that was his way of retaliating at her, was to cut off communication with me. You know, that was hard as a 9-year-old boy. And, you know, there was so much sort of after that, which we can get into if you want, but there's just a lot of sort of separations and divorces and financial catastrophes. And in the meantime, you know, I was responding to all of this the way that young boys often do, which is a lot of misadventures with my friends, a lot of drugs, a lot of drinking and driving, a lot of vandalism, fights. I barely graduated high school. And, sort of half impulsive decision to enlist in the US Air Force and then went to Yale on the GI Bill after that. But it was just a really strange and unusual path to higher education.
It's the sort of story where people say bullshit like there were miracles along the way. There was hard work along the way. You really, and a couple of crucial people said something out loud to you. One teacher got you to start reading, and you became, all this time, through all this chaos, a voracious reader. I was really floored, not floored, I was just in awe and admiration when you describe working in a restaurant as a teenager and start comparing the experiences you're having working in that restaurant to what you read in George Orwell's Down and Out in Paris and London, which is a book I read after working in restaurants for 15 years, but I read it when I was 30. I wasn't reading Orwell when I was 14. Reading the book, we all kind of know, and I think this makes us all complicit in the horrors of the foster care system. We all kind of know that it's not great, it's not ideal, that it's a shitty thing, that system to consign vulnerable children to, but we tend not to think about it. It's a little bit like we don't think about prisons and how destructive to human beings prisons can be almost by design. And reading page 4 of the book, you know, that was the first place I had to stop and kind of take a breath. When you just said that kids get shuffled around in foster care, they get moved from home to home intentionally. And so why do kids get shuffled around intentionally? Why does that happen? You explain it in the book, but explain it for us now.
Yeah, well, often what happens when a kid is in the system is someone from the family of origin reenters the picture. Either the parent, you know, in a lot of cases, perhaps even the majority, the reason why a kid is placed in the system in the first place is because the parent, usually the mother, has difficulties with addiction or mental illness. And so, you know, maybe the mother sobers up and is in a position to care for the child, or an aunt or a grandmother or someone is able to offer care while the kid is in the system. But if a child is in a foster home for too long, there can be difficulties around loyalty and attachment, where a child, if you know they've lived with a foster family for a year and they feel kind of emotionally invested in that family, and then suddenly their, you know, family member, father, someone enters and says, "Hey, okay, I can take care of the kid now." The kid often doesn't want to leave. On the other side of that, there's also the foster parents who, if they've been taking care of this small child for a year, they're often reluctant to let them go, and so the system kind of organically created this, less than ideal solution, which is essentially to move a child very frequently, every few months, in some cases, even just a few weeks, in order to prevent any attachment and any bond from forming, so that if and when someone from the family of origin does reenter the picture, the child will be happy to just go back with them.
That seems insane. The trauma of disrupting a bond that may have developed between a foster child and a foster parent would seem the lesser trauma than preventing a child from ever bonding with anyone, if a child is going to be, as you were, because of your circumstances, in the foster care system for a very long time, or sometimes permanently. We hear about kids who age out of the foster care system all the time. And it just seems sadistically backwards somehow, that to be torn away from, there were other kids in foster care that you would bond with or develop a kind of patterns and routines with, and a comfort with, or a foster parent. And then for the state to reach in and yank you from that, yank you from the school that you were going to, and drop you in a whole new place where you had to reassess. I mean, the cortisone levels that you must have had to ride out when you were 4 and 5 and 6 and 7.
Yeah, well, there are a couple of difficulties there that come to mind. I mean, one was sort of personally being relocated and shuffled around to different homes. The other was sometimes I would befriend my foster siblings and become, you know, close with them. You know, we'd rely on one another, and we were, you know, because, you know, again, a lot of these homes had just lots of kids, and the foster parents' attention, you know, was often spread very thin. And so we were sort of watching out for each other. And then one of my foster siblings would be taken to another placement or be returned with someone in their family. And so not only day to day did I not know where I was going to be living, but I also didn't know if I'd wake up tomorrow and one of my foster siblings, who I really liked, would be taken too. And so that level of sort of extreme uncertainty, it does sort of it burns a lot of physiological resources in a kid. And so, you know, the other thing is my system, you know, my time in the system, rather, it was, I just think like this is, it's emblematic of how overburdened the foster care system is, especially in large cities, which is, you know, it should have been apparent very early on that I should have been placed for adoption pretty much immediately because they couldn't locate my father. And my mother, because it was not, apparently this was not her first arrest and her sort of run-in with law enforcement, with drugs and so on. So she was deported back to Seoul. And I was a U.S. citizen. I was born in Los Angeles and I was sort of just absorbed into the foster system. And no one seemed to have actually sat down and realized that there was no hope of me ever being returned to my family of origin and to have just put me for adoption immediately. And instead what happened was, and I excerpt the letter from this child psychiatrist that I was ordered to see by the state of California. It was kind of a mandatory check-in that foster kids have to go through every so often. But this doctor actually sat down and read my file and he actually recognized, oh, you know, this kid is never going to be returned to his father or mother or anyone in his family. And he recommended I be placed into adoption. But I spent sort of 5 years, you know, in the system sort of rotating in and out of homes. And that was completely unnecessary. It's just because there's not enough people, not enough resources, not enough time for people to sort of tailor their approach to each kid the way that they should.
When I was adopting, when Terry and I, my husband and I, we adopted, the hoops we had to jump through, the things we had to prove, the psychological profiles, the medical backgrounds we had to give, the letters of recommendation from friends and family, and the screening from the agency. We didn't go through the state. We went through a private adoption agency. We're so thorough that, you know, at some points it felt like we would never be allowed to adopt. Reading about your adoption, and I hope this isn't like me being classist. I'm a working class kid. My dad's a cop. Like, I hope I'm not being classist. But reading about your adoption, I was, you know, I was so thrilled for you that first year with your adoptive parents when you had a sibling, walked you into what would be your own bedroom and your own clothes, shared toys with you. She had a piggy bank that she'd been saving money in, you know, for her first 3 years of life that she offered to split with you because you didn't have that. And this overwhelming sense that just comes across in the book of you, for the first time really since you were, I don't know, 3, 2, being able to exhale and feel like you belonged somewhere. And then for that all to come apart a year later, and for your adoptive father to have in him the ability to be so cruel to this child that he had, if he had not bonded with you, he had allowed to bond with him as a parent, floored me. Mm-hmm. Because I think that, you know, based on the screening process Terry and I had to go through, if we had the capacity for such, I don't know what else to call it, but evil in us, it would have been flagged and we would not have been allowed to adopt.
Yeah. And I've never heard this, like similar stories like this from other people who have been adopted or parents who have adopted. You know, it was, I think, a very sort of anomalous situation because, so let's see if I can recall correctly. So they must have been married for, I think, 8 years by this point. So, you know, they were married, they were both employed, they had a young daughter who became my adoptive sister. And so I think on paper, it all kind of looked good. You know, yeah, working class, but they were earning enough, they were sustained, you know, financially stable, and became less so after the divorce. But, you know, I can understand sort of just, you know, at first glance, at least, that they do seem to be like, you know, perfectly adequate, married, you know, whatever, like the environment that you would want a foster kid to go to. But I tried to be fair to him and I tried to sort of portray sort of every aspect of his character that I could remember. But yeah, it was a shock, I think, to my mother that he had that in him. It was a shock to me and my sister and I. You know, we still talk about that to this day, just how hard, because it was hard for her too, because she was still his daughter, you know, and she was close with me. And so it was just a very hard period, you know, time for the family.
Man, you have a way with the lightly tossed off parenthetical that's like a dagger to the heart. Mm-hmm. On page 86, you call him your father, you call him your father. And then there's this break and he's done this horrible thing. And for a little while after that, you still call him your father. Page 86, you're talking about being home with your mother. And there's just a parenthetical that says Hannah, which is the name of your sister. Hannah was with her dad, no longer our dad, no longer your dad. And man, that just like stopped my heart. And it's such beautiful writing. All right. There's a lot more to my conversation with Rob Henderson. Magnum subs always get a lot more extra content from me, including the Sex and Politics podcasts, the Magnum Savage Lovecast with more questions, more guests, and no ads, Struggle Sessions, where I respond to reader and listener comments, all of Savage Love, the column, the archives, invites to Savage Love Live, and more. You can try out being a sub for a month for just $8. If you like it, you can subscribe for a full year for just $40. You can also give a Magnum subscription as a gift. And hey, thank you for listening. Whether you're a micro listener and you get enough of me on the micro, or you're a Magnum sub who can't get enough, we love you either way, and we are so grateful for your ears and your support.